has also said he will not let any Republicans vote to raise the debt limit, while moving to block Democrats from doing so themselves. He plans to do so again on Wednesday, when the Senate will vote on whether to take up the legislation to raise the debt ceiling until December of 2022. If any Republicans object, it will take 60 votes to move forward, meaning that 10 GOP senators would have to join Democrats in doing so. No one really expects those Republican votes to materialize. Mitch McConnell has prescribed a single alternative for Democrats: use a complicated budget process known as reconciliation to maneuver around the Republican filibuster that he refuses to lift. "They need to do this, they have the time to do it, and the sooner they get about it, the better," he said on Tuesday. He even seemed to taunt Democrats a day after President Biden told Republicans they need to stop playing Russian roulette with the U.S. economy. Mitch McConnell, in his signature deadpan, looked into the television cameras on Capitol Hill to implore Democrats not to play Russian roulette with the American economy. Hardball tactics by Republicans on the debt ceiling are not new. Showdowns in 1995 and 1996 shut down the government but also helped foster a balanced budget agreement. A new Republican House majority in 2011 pushed the government so close to default that Standard & Poor's downgraded once unassailable U.S. debt, but it also produced the Budget Control Act, which crimped spending for years. The 2006 showdown has been used by both political parties as an object lesson. Mitch McConnell has pointed to it to show that partisanship is nothing new. Among the no votes on the debt ceiling increase that year were Senators Joseph R. Biden Jr. and Barack Obama. Democrats point to what they say is the more obvious lesson. They let the vote go through on a narrow majority with no filibuster. The same can be said for partisan debt ceiling increases passed in May of 2003 and November of 2004. This year is different. Not only are Republicans refusing to vote for the measure, they're creating an obstacle to stop Democrats from pushing it through themselves. "There's still time for 10 Republicans to join us, no matter what some of the extremists on the hard right think," Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the majority leader in the Senate, pleaded the day before the Wednesday vote to move to his debt ceiling bill. Senator Angus King of Maine, a moderate independent, sounded despondent. "There's no bargaining, they're just stamping their feet and saying no." He added, "It's a qualitatively new level of irresponsibility. With no overt policy demands to be met as the price for cooperation, Democrats say for Republicans, the chaos is the point, or at least a vague hope that the latest legislative crisis will somehow undermine Democrats' ability to fulfill unrelated parts of Joe Biden's agenda, especially an expensive bill to combat climate change and revive the fraying social safety net. Democrats are preparing another staggering taxing and spending spree without any Republican input or support," Mitch McConnell wrote on Monday. "Bipartisanship is not a light switch that Speaker Nancy Pelosi and leader Chuck Schumer may flip on to borrow money and flip off to spend it. Given that the switch is currently off," he argues, "Democrats have only one path forward. The Senate Budget Committee must produce a resolution that includes instructions to raise the debt ceiling, which must then pass the House and Senate and weather a barrage of hostile amendments. Then the House must draft a vote on a separate bill to lift the debt ceiling, which would then go to the Senate, where it could not be filibustered but would again have to survive an onslaught of politically difficult votes. Any proposal could be considered, and if any were adopted, the measure will be forced back to the House, and they have fewer than 14 days to do it. Democrats are left to seethe at their opponents' tactics. Mitch McConnell is singularly focused on winning control of the Senate in the 2022 midterm elections, full stop, said Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland and a longtime budget expert. To his mind, that means using every tactic at his disposal to cause President Biden to fail, even if that hurts the country. Mitch McConnell has another powerful political incentive for his stance. He cannot control his members and is reluctant to risk the ire of Republican base voters by leaning on senators to smooth the way for a debt limit increase. Even if Mitch McConnell wanted to allow one to come to a majority vote, a single senator could stop it. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who has made no secret of his presidential ambitions, said on Tuesday that he would block any such agreement, even one to expedite the process that McConnell is demanding. Mitch McConnell appeared to acknowledge his own tricky political position on Tuesday when he said that ending the filibuster threat would require getting consent from every single Republican, and he added, "I can't imagine that would happen." Senator Roy Blunt, Republican of Missouri, said 40 to 45 Republicans would be willing to agree to allow a debt ceiling increase to come to a vote as long as they did not have to cast a public ballot. The problem, he said, was the other five. Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, seemed almost relieved that Mitch McConnell had not put Democrats in a position where they would have to give in to conservative policy demands to stave off a Congress-imposed economic catastrophe. "I have learned over many years that we cannot negotiate over things like whether or not to destroy the economy," Mr. Schatz said, adding, "American politics has gone crazy because one party has gone crazy." With each passing day, the crisis becomes less avoidable. Each day, Democrats decline to give in to Mitch McConnell's demands to use the reconciliation process makes it that much more difficult for the maneuver to be completed in time to avoid a debt default. And each day the Democrats demand that Republicans blink. They reply that Democrats are to blame for not using the process of reconciliation when they had time to do so. "You still have time before you get to the edge of the cliff," Mr. Card said of the current debt ceiling showdown, "and that time should be used for dialogue. How will it end? One option that Mr. Van Hollen said Democrats might have to pursue, and that President Biden on Tuesday called a real possibility, is changing the filibuster rules so the borrowing limit increase and any in the future could pass with 50 votes. Mr. King, who has been unenthusiastic about changing the rules, said he had to agree. "I have been very reluctant for 9 years about modifying the filibuster rule, especially when it comes to policy. But this has nothing to do with policy," he said. "This is about keeping the United States and the world out of what could be a severe recession."
Has seen a countless number of events throughout centuries, including many wars and truces. But from the outset of the 21st century, something happened, something dramatic, that set off a chain of unnatural events.
Islam in Russia, Part 2.
After more than a decade, no one is really sure who actually set off what transpired. Many researchers are still studying its mysterious and contradictory details. But in the meantime, the finger has been pointed at a population a billion strong, with one thing in common, Islam. Yes, it was the Muslim community of the world that was blamed by the mainstream media for the September 11th tragedy and what ensued. But the strange thing is that in the first decade of the 21st century, Muslims were the main victims of wars and terrorist attacks. Take Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, Myanmar, Bahrain, and recently, in one of the most catastrophic of these complicated wars, Syria. But while Muslims are being accused of disrupting world order, history shows that wherever in the world they have lived, they have left relics of order and human civilization behind. And while Muslims are being massacred in the most horrendous ways in Syria, a huge country like Russia is one of their few allies. Russia's culture, art, science, and politics have made their mark on history with many famous names. Great writers and brilliant literary works like Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Crime and Punishment, War and Peace, Tchaikovsky, Shostakovich, ballets and memorable operas, Eisenstein, Pudovkin, the glorious cinema of the 1920s, Yuri Gagarin, Man on the Moon, famous names of the fluctuant history of this country, from the Viking and Mughal eras to the Tsarist period, and contemporaries like Marx, Lenin, socialism, communism, and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But there are things in Russia that the world knows less about. Residing in the neighborhood of the Russian Federation, even I didn't know that in a country I have always known for its great achievements of human civilization, lives more than 30 million native non-immigrant Muslims, whose ancestors have been living in this part of the world generation after generation for the last 1,300 years, and played a crucial role in forming the history of the world's largest country. The golden age of the Golden Horde lasted two centuries. The Golden Horde's king's reputation for justice and their tolerance for other religions also spread to all Islamic states. But when Timur invaded the Qajar fields in the Golden Horde's kingdom and the ruins it had caused, the state was demolished and was broken down into different khanates. After Timur's army began marching on Moscow, the people of the city restored Kazan, and the Khanate of Kazan that earlier was part of the Golden Horde became an independent and powerful state. Kazan was the most affluent Khanate among the split regions of the Golden Horde, a state that had made significant economic and commercial advances in which the influences of the Islamic civilization were apparent. The Kazan city of today is in the territory of these modern Khanates. Kazan is a green and lively city on the banks of the fertile Volga River, and it has been one of the main settlements of the Muslims of Russia throughout history. Manifestations of the Muslim cultural heritage in this town are famous mosques like Hol Sharif, Marjani, and Apianevsky, all of which have a unique history and architecture. From the middle of the 15th century, with the rising of the dynasty of Russia, the Russian princes began their efforts for independence from Mongolian rule. Eventually, in 1480, Ivan III refused to accept the rule of the Mongols and wrenched back a vast part of Russia from Mongolian rule. A few years later, the Great Invasion took place.
In the summer of 1552, an army of 150,000 men belonging to Ivan Grozny, historically known as Ivan the Terrible, invaded Kazan. The town was besieged by Russian aggressors. The October of that year coincided with Ramadan, the fasting month of the Muslims. Although they could have stayed alive by surrendering and giving them privileges, the Kazan defenders fought for Kazan until the last moment. Many Muslims were killed when the town was seized, including Sayyid Khosharif, the religious leader of the Tatars. Fighting for the resistance of Kazan until the last moment of his life, in the end he was thrown from the roof of his school by the Russian aggressors. Years later, in memory of Sayyid Khosharif's resistance, Russia's largest mosque was named after him. The Russians too, after massacring Muslims in Kazan and seizing their town, built the St. Vasil Church in Moscow in honor of their victory. Throughout history, the power in Russia has changed hands in many different periods. With the emergence of Russia's Tsar dynasty, a different era began for the Russian Muslims living in this land. This is the town of St. Petersburg in the northernmost point of the European part of Russia. St. Petersburg was established by Peter the Great, the fourth Tsar of the famous Romanov family, and down the years, it has become a base for the government of the Russian Tsars. The ruling era of the Russian Tsars was one of the hardest times for Russian Muslims. During this period, the Russian kings tried to convert the Muslim population of Russia to Christianity using a wide variety of methods, including mandatory baptism. Now it was time for the Muslims to be ruled over by the Christians, to pay taxes and be deprived of the rights they had before. Some of the Muslims pretended to accept Christianity but remained faithful to Islam. At this time, many of the Muslims, exasperated by the Russian government's pressure and the Christian church's compulsion, were forced to leave their hometown. One of the most reputable rulers of Tsarist Russia is Catherine the Great. Catherine was a princess from Germany who had entered the dynasty of the Russian Tsars after marrying Peter III. History is a roaring river that can uproot everything in its path, even giant trees with far-reaching roots. It can wash away vast terrain with weak soil and turn it into a derelict desert. But even in the most turbulent floods of history, the roots remain and sprout anew. The history of Russia is one of the most involved histories of mankind. A history that has, at various points, changed the course of world history. After many centuries of the Tsar's rule, the history of Russia entered a new phase in the early 1920s, and the Muslims of Russia also joined the new current that was forming. Even though relative freedoms were given to Muslims from Catherine's era onwards, the pressure was never completely lifted. That's why when in 1905 the people of Russia began to revolt against the empire of the Tsars, the Muslims who were under pressure in the Tsarist era the most joined the people's revolt. 1917, the Bolsheviks revolted under the leadership of Lenin. The communist revolution triumphed, and the Bolsheviks took over the running of the government. In the beginning, the Bolsheviks summoned not only Muslims, but all those who had been subjected to harassment and oppression during the Tsarist era and promised them freedom. And the Muslims, who were one of Russia's important and influential communities, joined the Bolsheviks in the 1917 revolution. From 1927 onwards, life became harder for Muslims in the communist state of the USSR. Cleric schools were closed and religious classes were eliminated from new schools. Mosques were demolished and shut down. Things reached a point where visiting a mosque meant losing one's social rights and even isolation and alienation from society. After a while, the only people who went to mosques were the elderly, peasants or workers. The Muslims were not allowed to perform any of their religious rites and ceremonies. The communists believed that in an advanced country, there is no room for religion. Marx was saying that religion is the opium of the masses and nations are being held back by religion. They were theoretically and practically trying to build an advanced and modern society by destroying religion. After Stalin's death, the anti-religious policies seemingly changed. There were no more sudden arrests, long imprisonments, and direct killings. However, if a Muslim went to one of the few active mosques, he would be summoned by the government's agents, and there he would need to explain why he went to a mosque. The people would gather in the gardens for prayer and put someone with an accordion at the door to guard. If someone came from the local assemblies or district offices, the Muslims would pretend they'd gathered in the garden for a celebration. Despite all the obstacles, the Muslims managed to preserve their religion for about 70 years in the socialist government of the USSR. Until in the year 1990, one of the turning points of Russian and world history. The USSR collapsed, the walls came down, and the people of Russia had the chance to choose their own paths, regardless of what political leaders wanted. After 7 decades of communist ideologies dominating most private aspects of human life, the people of Russia once again had the chance to choose freely. The Muslims once again began to build mosques and schools tirelessly. After 70 years of godlessness, the new generation eagerly began studying different religions and theologies. Today, the Muslims of Russia are a large, influential part of the Muslim community. About 30 million native non-immigrant Muslims are living in Russia, and in this country's large cities, Muslim districts deal with Muslim affairs. In the first decade of the 21st century in 2003, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, took part in the 10th Organization of Islamic Cooperation and announced that Russia is eager to become a member of this organization as a supervisor. 1 year later, in 2005, Russia was awarded this title, and the next year, the Strategic Landscape Group of Russia and the Muslim World was formed. These days, too, the people of the world hear the name Russia frequently via global media. What's being reported now is Russia's support for Syria, a Muslim country in which one of the most horrendous ongoing terrorist operations is happening. And also the terrorist attacks happening in Russian cities in which ordinary citizens are being killed, in the metro and in bus stations. Some are trying to make the world believe that these terrorists are Muslims. But the unanswered question that keeps going around and around in my mind is, how can these people, who held on to their religion with tooth and claw during Russia's turbulent history from Tsars to the communists, and who have managed to stay in the roaring river of history, behave in a way that would destroy the image of their religion?
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
People who receive two COVID-19 jabs and later contract the Delta variant are less likely to infect their close contacts than are unvaccinated people with Delta. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Smriti Malapati, researcher. This article is published under the heading COVID vaccines cut risk of transmitting Delta, but not for long. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The first study to look directly at how well vaccines prevent the spread of the Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2 brings good news and bad. The study shows that people who become infected with the Delta variant are less likely to pass the virus to their close contacts if they have already had a COVID-19 vaccine than if they haven't. But that protective effect is relatively small and dwindles alarmingly at 3 months after the receipt of the second shot. The findings add to scientists' understanding of the vaccination's effect on curbing Delta's spread, but are both more and less encouraging, says Marm Kalprick, an infectious disease researcher at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Previous studies have found that people infected with Delta have roughly the same levels of viral genetic materials in their noses, regardless of whether they had previously been vaccinated, suggesting that vaccinated and unvaccinated people might be equally infectious. But studies also suggest that vaccinated people are less likely to spread the virus if they subsequently catch Delta. The levels of nasal virus drop faster than those of unvaccinated infected people, and their nasal swabs contain smaller amounts of infectious virus. The latest study examined the effect of vaccines on transmission more directly. It analyzed testing data from 139,164 close contacts of 91,716 people infected with SARS-CoV-2 between January and August 2021 in the UK, when the Alpha and Delta variants were competing for dominance. The authors found that although the vaccines did offer some protection against infection and onward transmission, Delta dampened that effect. A person who was fully vaccinated and then had a breakthrough Delta infection was almost twice as likely to pass on the virus as someone who was infected with Alpha. And that was on top of the higher risk of having a breakthrough infection caused by Delta than one caused by Alpha. Unfortunately, the vaccine's beneficial effect on Delta transmission waned to almost negligible levels over time. In people infected 2 weeks after receiving the vaccine developed by a pharmaceutical company both in the UK, the chance that an unvaccinated close contact would test positive was 57%, but 3 months later that chance rose to 67%. The latter figure is on par with the likelihood of an unvaccinated person will spread the virus. A reduction was also observed in people vaccinated with the jab. The risk of spreading the Delta infection soon after vaccination with that jab was 42%, but increased to 58% with time. There is a step change with Alpha versus Delta, but then there is also a change over time, says co-author David Eyre, an epidemiologist at the University of Oxford, UK. The results possibly explain why we have seen so much onward transmission of Delta, despite widespread vaccination. But the results also offer the intriguing possibility that if you do run a booster campaign because you want to protect individuals, it may also have this effect of reducing transmission, says Eyre. Booster campaigns raise a new uncertainty, says Stephen Riley, an infectious disease researcher at Imperial College London. Whether the same waning of protection from infectiousness will occur after the third dose. The study has not yet been peer-reviewed. Doc Review.
Hello, Anne. and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Naseeb Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masood Shajareh, who is the Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know? And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do, nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show. And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it's not really a kind of comprehensive look at the situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk. And of course, his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him. And he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm. So and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved. But some of the men went to Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
It's pretty much essentially that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masood, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, I, as the film was about the franchised sort of youth getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of, what it sort of tackled is that here Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop, with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost.
So
you're
saying there's multiple messages in this book.
It is, but I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, is talking about his friend who's just gone, and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually topped by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which is being disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them. And out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary surely is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that
or
is something.
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits
atrocities at home. I mean, this is you know, is a really a challenge for our society to first of all to understand this phenomenon and then to address it if possible. And this is sort of did not actually reach that. Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and have nothing to do, and of the fact that they're, you know, I mean, they were saying that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing, you know.
That's
I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Al-Shabaab looked for vulnerable young teenagers who had problems, your families, you have problems with the government, you have issues with peace, you are an easy target for Al-Shabaab because the person's mind is already crafted and polluted, you know, in his own mind. He doesn't trust the police because the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He comes forward, like me, he joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where a Somali, young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world. And they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that there are forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk, the elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in the real sense for the right thing, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something, they want to be part of a solution, and I think we're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving message that end justifies the means. And that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
The film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. They're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to mm-hmm. do. And it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's
story.
A merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, mm-hmm. and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life. I used to think that killing is okay, that, black backing yourself up with suicide bombing, exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, you know, and I saw that it was wrong, you know, endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Ashraf. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, you know, being tricked into just endless killing non-stop. I want to change.
There's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be, I don't know what he's done. Has he
but
done
in the film,
anything
does it,
illegal?
Does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, you know, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story,
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Masood, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining extremist groups?
Well, really, it's difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know that, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam, but unfortunately our way of combating it is all geared towards you got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives, one for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has had backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, it's backfiring now, it's backfiring in Syria. And out of that it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslims, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of the society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about, and I kind of wish it had. But then, that's another film. So.
Mm-hmm. And final thoughts for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long, and it raises many questions. But as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine that I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come out fairly strongly about immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambayasi.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.